Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for September's Nurses Club webinar. I am delighted to introduce you to our speaker for today, Certified Veterinary Technician Specialist in Cardiology, Charlotte Pace. Thank you, Charlotte. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hi. Thank you very much for joining this webinar. I hope you can all hear me fine. So what we're going to be covering today is that we're going to be looking at the common presentations of dog and cat heart disease. So we're going to focus on the more common diseases, but we'll have a look at some other things that you can see sometimes if you're working in practice or if you do work in referral centres. Okay, so things that we're going to cover, so just so that we're all at the same place, we're going to start with looking at some terminology, so making sure that when we talk about heart disease, we're aware of what we're talking about. Then we'll move on to acquired diseases. So these are by far and away the more common disease that you'll see in practice, and we'll look at dog diseases and cat disease. Then we'll move on very briefly to look at congenital diseases, arrhythmias and pericardial disease, as these do present to you in practice occasionally. And then we'll look at disease staging, because I think it's important that we understand what is actually going on within the patient, because that will actually affect our nursing. It will help guide us and the vets as to what diagnostic tests will be needed. And then we'll look at diagnosis, so we'll look at the tests that are needed. We'll hopefully be able to address the nursing concerns that you have or that I have during the actual seminar itself. Okay, so starting off really just to make sure we all understand or remember our cardiac anatomy. So we've got four chambers of the heart. We've got two atria, two ventricles. We've got the left atrium, and then that's split by the mitral valve, and then we've got the left ventricle. Now, the left side of the heart goes, the blood comes in from the pulmonary veins, oxygenated, goes into the left ventricle across the open mitral valve, and then into the left ventricle, and is pushed in systole out through the aortic valve and into the aorta, and then round the body. So this side has higher pressures because this is the side of the heart which is going to be getting blood to the brain, to the kidneys, to your toes, to the rest of the body. Then we've got a lower pressure side, which is our right hand side. And so on this side, we've got our right atrium. We've got the blood comes into the right atrium via the vena cava. So you've got your cranial and caudal vena cava. Then the blood in the right atrium goes across the tricuspid valve into the right ventricle, and then is pushed again out through systole, is pushed out through the pulmonary artery and off to be oxygenated. So if we now just quantify what we're talking about when we talk about different terms, and I think from my time in practice, these terms can get a little bit confused. So bear with me if this is really basic, but I just need to make sure that everybody understands what we're talking about. So when we talk about heart murmurs, so with a heart murmur, we're talking about any abnormal heart sound of a prolonged duration. So when you're doing your auscultation, whether it be as a routine or whether you're listening for something specific, it's an abnormal heart sound. So we're taking our normal as lub-dub, and then we have a heart sound either between the lub and the dub or between the dub and the lub. Okay, and so that would be known as as prolonged duration, as an abnormal sound of prolonged duration. So then we come to heart disease. So heart disease is any abnormality of cardiac structure or function. So this can be something that can be congenital or it can be acquired. And then finally, when we talk about heart failure, we're talking about the clinical signs of increased tissue water and or decreased tissue perfusion. And heart failure has to be a result of heart disease. Okay, so when we're talking about increased tissue water, then we're talking about things like pulmonary edema, pleural effusion or ascites, or we're talking about decreased tissue perfusion. So the heart is unable to fulfill its cardiac output needs, and so you have a decrease in tissue perfusion. So if we just think about things that can cause heart murmurs, so obviously we're listening to a seminar on heart disease. So the primary thing that we're going to talk about today, obviously, is the actual diseases that can cause heart murmurs. So we think primarily of things like leaking valves. So that is things like our mitral valve disease, so a degenerative process that happens, and we can stage our heart murmurs to actually stage the disease. So the louder the murmur, then the more severe the disease. But we can also see things like stenotic valves, so things like pulmonic stenosis or aortic stenosis. And so aortic stenosis is a more common stenotic disease that we will see in practice. Predisposed breeds are breeds like boxers and our larger breed dogs. And so when you're listening to stenotic valves, and your murmur is actually typically higher, so it's much more under the armpit, whereas where you're listening with a leaking valve, then it's more apical, so it's down towards the sternum. And then we've also got holes in the heart. So most typically these are ventricular septal defects, so you've got a hole between your septal wall. But we can get heart murmurs for other different reasons, and so this can sometimes be a little bit confusing. So we can get flomas for what we call either innocent or physiological murmurs. So perhaps maybe you've heard of somebody when they were born, they were told they had a heart murmur, or if you were pregnant and you told that you had a heart murmur at that time and it disappears. And these are heart murmurs that just occur because for example, if you're pregnant, or if you are you're in the stages of growing really rapidly, then your body is really trying to keep up with you, and so these murmurs do disappear, but they are present, particularly in sort of those sort of higher levels of activity within the body. But we can also see in veterinary medicine, we can also see murmurs associated with anemia. So we have a volume loading with anemia because your body is trying to create more red blood cells. So you have a volume loading situation, which, again, if you can cure the anemia, you can actually get rid of that heart murmur. But then also we have hyperthyroidism. So some of you may have heard cats with things like Gallop rhythms, or just with a heart murmur associated with hyperthyroidism. And again, this is due to the tachycardic state that the hyperthyroidism will put onto the animal, particularly, especially obviously cats that we see. And so that increase in cardiac output, that increased turnover, can create heart murmurs. So as we can see here, so really just to recap the slide, that heart murmurs can have other causes as well as heart disease. And so that's why you'll see that vets will often look for other reasons to see why the particular patient has a heart murmur. Okay, so we move on to heart disease. So we're looking at anything that has an abnormality of cardiac structure or a function. And so what we have to be aware of with heart disease is that you may or may not see clinical signs associated with it. Generally, as it says on this slide, that clinical signs are usually the result of heart failure. So the things that we may commonly associate with our clinical signs are things like lethargy, coughing, exercise intolerance, or syncope. These are usually signs that the heart is unable to cope, is unable to create the amount of cardiac output that's actually needed for that patient to continue normally. However, you can have heart disease. So again, some of you may know people who do have things like a hole in the heart. Doesn't mean that you have heart failure. It's a form of disease. So we will start here, and we'll come to heart failure a little bit later when we actually look at classifications of disease. So if we start now by looking at acquired heart disease, and so we're looking at these particular diseases that develop generally later in life. Now, of course, like I've just said, with heart disease, you can have different stages of heart disease. So you can have a very mild form, you can have a very severe form. In the same way with your acquired heart disease, you can, although we say it's acquired, it can be something that develops earlier in life than perhaps we think it might. So we might see, for example, a healthy Cavalier King Charles Spaniel who has a heart murmur, maybe aged 2 years old, and then we kind of watch that as we go along through life and make records of that as it goes through its life. So generally it's a later in life disease. So we look at mitral valve disease, which we'll look at these in detail in a moment. We'll also look at cardiomyopathies. So we can see hypertrophic cardiomyopathy in cats, and we can see dilated cardiomyopathy in dogs. Now, again, as the slide says here, so a heart murmur may not be present with our cardiomyopathies. If we think back to the slide just before about what causes heart disease, then we actually need something in the way that's causing that that heart murmur to occur. So it could be a stenotic valve where you've got a higher pressure that's trying to pass through valves, or with a leaking valve, so you have blood flow going the wrong way. With your cardiomyopathies, it's not necessarily going to generate a heart murmur. So we've also got things like arrhythmias, and so this is where we would rarely see a heart murmur present. What we would hear on auscultation with an arrhythmia, and particularly if we're feeling pulses as well, would be either gaps or an irregular rhythm or something that either is far too fast or far too slow. But to hear a heart murmur is very rare, unless of course it's a breed that has a heart murmur. So nobody's saying that, for example, you couldn't have a ventricular septal defect, but you can also have an arrhythmia at the same time. But whether or not they're associated is highly unlikely. Then we've got pericardial disease. So pericardial disease we'll have a look at again later. Usually it can be idiopathic, but quite often is seen as a neoplastic process. And so again, it's usually an extracardiac thing, so outside the heart, and so will not necessarily cause the heart murmur. We can also see cardiac tumours, which we'll cover with our pericardial disease. And again, we would not suspect a murmur to be present, because again, the places where cardiac tumours will actually are quite often situated, like your hemangiosarcomas, are usually in lower pressure chambers. But again, we can't ever say never is never. And then finally, infective endocarditis. So this would be a bacterial or a vegetative lesion, which could be on a heart valve. So by the fact that it would stop a heart valve closing properly, it could give a murmur. But again, the more common presentation with endocarditis would be a patient who is sort of waxing and waning with clinical signs, so pyrexia, non-pyrexia, lethargy, non-lethargy, and you do things like blood cultures to be able to rule in or rule out alongside the other diagnostic tests we'll have a look here on this seminar. Okay, so we're going to move on to degenerative mitral valve disease, so actually looking at the diseases that we see in practice. So degenerative mitral valve disease comes with many, many different names. In veterinary nursing textbooks, it's always lumped in as atrioventricular disease, which doesn't really do it, it does it a bit of a disservice, to be honest. The most common atrioventricular valve to be affected is the mitral valve, and so when working with cardiologists, you'll see that they will refer to just the mitral valve, because you may or may not have degeneration of the tricuspid valve as well. Now, the reason, again, whilst we're more interested in the mitral valve is, as I alluded to on the first slide, is that mitral valve disease affects the left side of the heart. And the left side of the heart is that side that's really important for getting blood out into the body, so out to the aorta, but also collecting it back in through the pulmonary veins into the left atrium. So if we have a problem on this side, it actually compromises our patient much sooner than it does on the right hand side. So degenerative mitral valve disease, it's the most common cardiac disease that we will see in practice. If you've not heard a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel with a heart murmur, then I suggest you start listening to Cavalier King Charles Spaniels. So many of them do have them. Males are more predisposed and they get a more aggressive form of the disease, but I would really recommend start listening to Cavaliers if you're not already from sort of age 2 or 3 onwards. We also see it in different breeds like Dachshunds and quite a lot of the Terrier breeds as well. So it's a lot of the smaller breed dogs that we will see in practice. So if we actually look and see what happens with degenerative mitral valve disease, so these are two echo pictures. Apologies for those of you who aren't used to looking at echo, but I will try and talk us through so we can have a look and see what's going on. So if we refer to that top left picture with mitral valve disease, so you can see there we've got the left atrium and the left ventricle that are clearly labelled. And then we've got our mitral valve. So where the two arrows are, you can see that that's our mitral valve. Now, our mitral valve leaflets, if they're normal and healthy, should look nice and clean and should shut really nicely. However, what we can see here is that you've got thickened mitral valve leaflets, and when they actually do close, so in systole when they are supposed to close, they can't because they're thickened and gnarled. And the result of that we can then see in the bottom right hand picture is where you have a leak of blood which goes back into the left atrium. So that big systolic push that should push all the blood out through the aorta, because it's a big push and it's easier for blood to flow back into the left atrium. So obviously the vast majority of it goes out through the aorta, but as you can see here, you'll have blood flow going back into the left atrium because the mitral valve hasn't closed properly. Just to give you an idea as to the colours on that slide, so basically the green colour there is turbulent flow, so that is blood that's going the wrong direction. The blue should be going in there, so that should be blood going into the left ventricle, but that green is saying that basically there's blood flow going the wrong direction. So if we have a look at sort of the severity of the disease that we can see, and I have alluded to this already, that you do get a spectrum of disease. So if we look at that first one where the arrow is, so we've got a normal left side of the heart there. So we've got left atrium, left ventricle, and you can see there with the mitral valve leaflets, in comparison to what we were just looking at, you've got nice, thin mitral valve leaflets there. You can see the cordy tendini that are coming away into the left ventricle, but you can see also that your left atrium is a nice small square and your left ventricle, we normally say that you should be able to approximately fit two of the left atrium into the left ventricle, so that kind of works out there that we can see in the normal slide. If we move now to the mild, and so the mild, you've got a bigger left atrium. So if you compare to the normal there, you've got a bigger left atrium. You can also see that left ventricle is getting a little bit bigger as well. So we can see that the mitral valve leaflets are a bit thicker on that slide, so they're a little bit more distended in that picture than they are from normal. And then finally, we look at severe. And so with the severe, you can see that left atrium is really round now. So compare that to your normal, where you've got that nice square. Now we're looking at a rounded left atrium. We'll also then see that left ventricle. The left ventricle, rather than looking nice and almost cigar-shaped in your normal slide, you've now got a left ventricle that is vastly dilated, that's looking almost like a football, really, rather than that nice, slim sort of cigar shape you've got in the normal. And then finally, obviously, you can see the reason why that's happened, and you've got a really thickened mitral valve leaflet there. Look, you can see that even if it wanted to, can't shut properly. And what we can see sometimes is actually what we call acute decompensation. So this is where, like, normally your heart can compensate for disease, so you don't show clinical signs, so we call that compensated. But what can sometimes happen in severe cases of mitral valve disease is that you get acute decompensation, and that will occur because what can happen is that your cordy tendon can actually rupture. And so if you see in this this picture here where the arrow is pointing, you can see that's actually a piece of the mitral valve that has ruptured and is now when every time the heart beats in systole, it actually flicks back into the left atrium. And obviously if you don't have that mitral valve leaflet correctly tethered to the ventricle, you have no hope of being able to maintain cardiac output. So this really is quite an end stage mitral valve disease at this particular stage. So I think we need to have a look and to see how severe it is, because obviously we've just looked at the worst case scenario. So if we look at, or we ask the question, does heart disease always cause death? Well, basically, in the study done by Borgarelli et al. In 2012, then basically their study showed that in dogs with mitral valve disease, so 60% of 256 dogs lived for more than 5.5 years after diagnosis. So as we've said, mitral valve disease is relatively common. So that's why we've got quite a large number of dogs in this study. But we can also see that it stages. So as the normal, moderate or mild and severe echo pictures showed you, you can see that it isn't a death sentence to have mitral valve disease. Okay. So now we can move on to dilated cardiomyopathy. So dilated cardiomyopathy is a disease we generally see in larger breed dogs. And so we see this particularly in breeds like Dobermans, Newfoundlands, Boxers. Some of these breeds, breed societies do have screening programs as well. So with dilated cardiomyopathy, what we see here is that basically the ventricle muscle, so the myocardium within the left ventricle, becomes weak, and so it's unable to pump blood effectively out through the aorta. And so what happens with that is that basically your left ventricle will dilate. There's room for it to expand, and so it will dilate so it can get more blood into the left ventricle, so that on every pump out through the aorta that you've got more blood that it should be able to pump out. Now, of course, as you can see in these two different slides, again, if we look at the right hand side, which is our normal slide, so we've got our nice square looking left atrium, we've got our left ventricle there looking very nice, and again, we should be able to fit two of the left atria into that left ventricle. If you have a look at the dilated cardiomyopathy slide, so that left-hand slide, we can really see the size of that left ventricle. And if you can, and it's not a fantastic way to look at it, but if you have a look at that ventricular wall, so if you see, if I just have a quick draw, so with the arrow, we can see here that you've got a really thin wall. If you compare that comparatively on your normal heart, you can see how much thinner that ventricular wall is. And again, you need that pressure to be able to push out through the aorta. You need a muscle that can do that. And so that's our problem with dilated cardiomyopathy. And this is why you don't necessarily have a heart murmur with dilated cardiomyopathy. If you do, then it's usually because as the ventricle gets wider, then actually your mitral valve apparatus, so your mitral valve apparatus being here, that your mitral valve can't close properly. And so that's the reason why you might have a murmur with it, but your ventricle has to get quite dilated, i.e. your disease has to get quite severe, before that will actually happen. Okay, so with our looking at dilated cardiomyopathy. So if we look at, again, ask the same question, does heart disease with dilated cardiomyopathy always cause death? Now, the difficult thing with dilated cardiomyopathy is that once it's found, then 50% of dogs will die within 4 months. And that's really quite obviously a shocking statistic. But the cardiologists think that the reason why this is the case is that by the time that dogs present with clinical signs, then the disease is really quite severe. Because dilated cardiomyopathy, our signs are that muscle, that cardiac muscle gets weaker. And there's no way we can really know that. So these signs are actually really quite hidden until it's really quite severe. If a dog goes for a vaccination, it can still have dilated cardiomyopathy, but as we've just shown, doesn't necessarily have to have a heart murmur. And so by the time that these dogs actually present, they've usually either got heart failure associated with the dilated cardiomyopathy. And so that's obviously a bad stage to be at, to know the sort of the problem that will give you only a few months longevity. But also the other thing that dilated cardiomyopathy can cause are ventricular arrhythmias. So basically the muscle is hypoxic, it's been overworked. And so parts of that will fire off ventricular arrhythmias. And so you can get, and this is a problem particularly with Dobermans, and a lot of work has been done on this recently, but you can get sudden death due to ventricular arrhythmias. And for owners, obviously this is very difficult, but again, for warning signs, it's really quite poor for us to be able to help. Okay, so when we see with the dilated cardiomyopathy that what's happening now is that research is really working on focusing on early detection, and there are drug companies that are looking at really focusing particularly on Dobermans in catching that early disease as early as possible, and so looking to see where nurses can help with that would be really, really useful. But the paper that presented through the dilated cardiomyopathy is called PROTECT, and that gives a whole algorithm looking at dilated cardiomyopathy and looking at breeds at risk. Okay, so just to wrap up, when we're looking at clinical signs with mitral valve disease and dilated cardiomyopathy, so things that we are looking for as nurses, but also what we're advising owners. So we really can look for increased respiratory rate. So we're looking to see how fast resting respiratory rate, what dogs are breathing. We all know that the normal respiratory rate for dogs. And so getting owners just into a good habit, particularly if they have breeds that are associated with heart disease. So your Cavaliers, your Terriers, your Dobermans, your Newfoundlands, and get them to start counting their respiratory rate when they're sleeping, when they're at rest. Because then obviously, as we know, each patient is different. We can start picking up subtle signs as quickly as possible. Other things that we can see as clinical signs that owners will come in and report are things like exercise intolerance. And they can range from, you know, our boxer dog doesn't run the 10 miles on the bikes with us to, well, he gets puffed out walking up the stairs. So, again, getting owners to be aware of things like that. Also, weakness and lethargy, we can see that come along with the clinical signs. We can also see potentially with coughs as well. And so coughs can be associated with an enlarged left atrium, because if we've got an enlarged left atrium, it actually compresses the trachea slightly. But we can also see it if they have pulmonary edema. So fluid in the lungs, they will cough as well. So obviously it's important to know that animals can cough for different reasons. But again, if we're looking at breeds with specific predisposition to these diseases, it's a suspicious sign. We can also see syncope, so sudden fainting. As we've already discussed with dilated cardiomyopathy, it can be something that's seen. And obviously then we'd be looking at congestive heart failure, which we'll have a look at a little bit further on. Okay, so enough dogs, let's look at some cats now. So cats can be quite difficult, as I'm sure probably a lot of you already know. Cats with their heart disease, I'm afraid they fit that stereotype. They really are just quite difficult. So what can give us any ideas about cats? Well, if we look at their age range, well, they can be from about 6 months to about 12 years, but you can get 12-week-old kittens that have got heart disease. We can look at 16-year-old cats that will present with heart disease. So it really is a very wide plane for cats. It's been shown to be a genetic defect in Maine Coons, and we know that your special breeds like Persians, Ragdolls and Bengals are predisposed. This is all to hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. However, of course, because of the fact that cats have interbred since day one, so most of the cats we will see will be moggies, and whether we can blame that on a pedigree or whether it's just bad luck, who knows? So when we look at hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, so basically what happens, it's the reverse of what happens with dilated cardiomyopathy. So the heart muscle becomes too thick. And what happens then, obviously, is the converse to what happens with dilated cardiomyopathy. So there isn't enough room for blood to enter the left ventricle because the heart muscle gets thicker and thicker. And so what then starts to happen is that your left atrium will start to enlarge, and you'll have blood that will then not be being returned or will pool from within the lungs. And the way that cat's anatomy works slightly is that we can get that, so it can actually form into a pleural effusion, because you've got blood flow into that are draining into the lungs will actually present as pleural effusion, but cats can also get pulmonary edema, both as a result of left-sided heart disease. So we'd like to think, obviously, that what we can do is say, well, if a cat's got a heart murmur, it's definitely got heart disease. Unfortunately not. A study that was done in 2010 by Wagner et al. Showed that a study done in apparently healthy cats, so no physical signs whatsoever, that out of 199 cats, 66% of cats had no heart murmur, but we had 34% that did have a heart murmur. So that's a third of cats who appear perfectly healthy have a heart murmur. So let's hold that and let's move on to the next slide, where we can see that 50% of healthy cats with murmurs have no heart disease. So again, if we're now looking at it, we're bringing down this pool as to how many cats really do have heart disease, but we really can see, so they can have a heart murmur, but they can have no heart disease. Or we've got cats with no heart murmurs that do have heart disease. And so this really just backs that up. So the 16% of cats in this study, so they had no heart murmur, but they did have heart disease. And so this is where cats can really become quite difficult. And so really for us, and you could be sitting there right now being quite confused, and I would agree with you as to why are cats just so flipping complicated. And I can completely understand how this comes about. But basically, if we treat cats as though cats can have heart disease, and they can have quite severe heart disease and have no heart murmur, and if we can accept that, then we can then accept that cats who do have heart murmurs can actually be quite healthy. And I can show you why cats do have heart murmurs. And this is what we call, rather long-windedly, but can be called left ventricular outflow tract obstruction or systolic anterior motion. So if we come back to our cardiac anatomy. So the red colour there, we've got our red atrium, we've got our mitral valve, we've got our left ventricle there. And so what can happen, and this is why it's called an outflow tract obstruction. So if we consider that the aorta is our outflow tract, it's a tract that's leaving the left ventricle. And so if we see that every time the heart pushes blood out in systole, that it has to pass our valve leaflet there. And so cats can have, or it's thought that this is linked to, as the similar in humans, that you can have a slightly overlong mitral valve leaflet. And so what can happen is that that long leaflet can get caught. So when you have the blood that pushes out under pressure, again, remember, if you're taking blood pressure down by the carpus and you're getting a blood pressure of 180, that has to be at least 180 millimeters of mercury in that left atrium. And so by pushing out the blood flow, and let's say our cat is stressed or scared and that heart rate goes up, so that increases the pressure, that mitral valve gets sucked back into the aorta. Blood flow hits an object and will create a heart murmur. And so this is where, when it says at the bottom there that the murmur gets worse at higher heart rates, because let's think for a moment. If you were in the shower, you turn on your shower to full blast, and if you've got a shower curtain, the shower curtain immediately sticks to your leg. Okay, that is almost like left ventricular outflow tract obstruction, because you have a high pressure, and so the valve leaflet or the shower curtain in the example I'm giving sucks to your leg. Okay, that is left ventricular outflow tract obstruction. However, you turn down the shower and the shower curtain will return back to the side of the bath. And so this is exactly what happens. So a cat gets stressed, therefore that mitral valve leaflet is sucked back into the aorta. And what you can sometimes get with the black arrow that's there is you almost get what we call a kissing lesion, where that valve leaflet, if the cat is at high heart rates a lot, you actually get a kissing lesion where that valve leaflet touches the ventricle. So that is how cat heart murmurs, they can have heart murmurs, but they need not have heart murmurs, but also how it gets worse when it's in practice. If you have a cat yourself that has a heart murmur, then you can test this out. I struggle because my cat purrs as soon as I stick my stethoscope on his thorax, but it's worth seeing to see whether or not they do actually have a heart murmur at home. Okay, so another little slide. So if a cat has heart disease, does it always cause death? Well, again, you see, with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, like with mitral valve disease, actually you can have heart disease and you can live. So this study done by Jay Payne et al. So 60% of 127 cats that she surveyed lived for more than 5 years after diagnosis. So is it a death sentence? Well, no, because cats become hyperthyroid, they get kidney disease, they can be hit by cars. There's so many other ways that our patients can be affected. Okay, so again, remember that we said that cats are complicated. Well, you see, the thing is, it really is quite difficult. Often there are no historical signs, so it may be that you'll hear from the breeder or from the owner that the sister, mother, brother died suddenly, and that can unfortunately be the first clinical sign. We can sometimes see increased respiratory rate and increased respiratory effort. We can sometimes see that they've become depressed or exercise intolerant. But again, if you can spot that your cat has become depressed or exercise intolerant on a cold day when they can sit by the radiator all day, then I really do congratulate you. Otherwise, one of our presenting signs is aortic thromboembolism, or ATE, or feline aortic thromboembolus. And so that is something that we do need to be aware of. We have probably seen, and actually I'll show you a few slides in a moment, which will show you how that can originate from heart disease itself. We can also sometimes see syncope or weakness in cats, but one of our main clinical signs in cats is sudden death. So it really is quite difficult. And always remember that if you hear a cat cough, then it's more likely to be a respiratory problem, so for example feline asthma, than it is going to be something like heart failure. Okay, so we're now going to have a look at a couple of videos which will just show you the different presentations or the different ways to deal with cats who can present with heart disease. So this is a cat who turned up at our hospital and arrived like this. Okay, so this is quite a horrid thing to do, and some of you, and you'd be quite rightly thinking, why, this is my video, why on earth am I standing there videoing a cat when it's breathing like that? And hopefully we all realize that cats shouldn't breathe like that. So if we move to the next slide, the next video, and so with the next video, now we can see this is 10 minutes later. And so all we've done 10 minutes later is that we've given one dose of furosemide IM. And the blanket at the end there was because there were people messing around behind. So that was just to block off and try to minimize stress for our pussycat. But you can still see open mouth breathing there. Cat's certainly not right by any stretch of the imagination. So then we move to the final one. So this is 30 minutes later. So by this stage, our cat has now had two doses of furosemide. And what we've had to do, because the cat is so distressed, so we've given a sedative at this point. And you can see that she's still not breathing well. But she is now calmer, so she's not doing that automatic gasping that she was doing in the previous two slides. So I guess then we need to say, well, why is that happening? And so what this cat had was what we call pulmonary edema. And so this is a radiograph showing this pulmonary edema. So if I just get my arrow back and I can show you, so all this white fluffy stuff that's in her lungs, so here. So all of that white stuff, so this is the lung field, this should be black, and all of this area, that is fluid within the lungs. And so you can imagine why that cat was breathing like that, because you've got so much fluid there, you cannot oxygenate, you cannot get oxygen in those blood vessels to be able to oxygenate the body. So then, if we just come to finally, so, and this is just beautiful because this is how cats really are. So this was 3 days later. 3 days later, this cat is now ready to go home. You can see how she's just being a cat. That's my fingers in there trying to get attention. And she's an excellent example of a cat saying, I don't really want to know you at all. But you can see now she's vaguely interested in what's going on in the world, obviously much more happy sitting in her litter tray. But by this stage, and it did take all day to get an IV catheter into her because her state was so fragile that we really had an issue in getting catheter in her, which obviously was the best thing that we could do, but we have to be mindful of the fact that by stressing a cat that much, we could make it 40 times worse. Okay, so then we've got what we quite often see is a pleural effusion. And so this is where when we get thoracentesis, you've probably seen this in practice. And what you've got down at the bottom here, if my arrow will move. There we go. Right. Okay, so what we've got down here, so you can see how you lose the outline of the heart there at the bottom. So you've got this pleural effusion. So fluid, and again, that is going to compress the lung fields because your fluid is heavier than air, and so therefore you cannot expand those lungs when you've got that much fluid within the lung fields. And so this may be familiar to quite a few of you, to thoracentesis. So getting a butterfly catheter and removing fluid from the thoracic cavity, so removing your pleural effusion. Always worthwhile taking samples and sending them off, and as I'm sure all vet nurses know, to keep the samples anyway, rather than throw them away. Okay, so I said that I'd come back and discuss how thromboemboli happen. And so what we can see here, and it's if I just bring my arrow down again to show you, so this is our left atrium. So this whole area here is left atrium, this is left ventricle, mitral valve is across here. But what we can see here, and what you can see live with this with this particular picture is that this is what we call spontaneous echo contrast, or smoke. It's called smoke because it looks like smoke, and it just swirls around. And this comes as a result of that thick left ventricle. And we know that if blood can't move, blood slows down. If blood slows down, it starts to slow down. You can see it sometimes with this spontaneous echo contrast. But the next thing that it will do if it slows down sufficiently is that it will cause a thrombus. And so here where the blue arrow is, you can see it's a different echo view this, but you can see where that arrow is, that is a clot. And so they quite often hold up in that left atrial appendage. Again, cats being awkward have this almost where it goes round to the left auricular appendage, goes round to a quite a narrow, almost like teardrop shape. And so that's just perfect for blood that starts to slow down and wants to form a clot. And so this is what quite often happens. And then what happens with this clot is that then a piece of that will break off, and then we'll see something like this. So we will see that that clot from that left atrium will have moved from the heart, so from that left atrium across the mitral valve, out through the left ventricle and aorta, and it will land wherever it wants to. And so unfortunately, one of the places it will often land is literally at the so we can see our thrombus here, and we will see that literally at the bifurcation of your femoral artery. So there has to choose either to go down the left or the right, and so it will just sit there and will acutely make that cat lame and extremely painful. And this is what you see when you see the cat on the left turning up like this. But it can only happen if you've got thrombi formation within the left atrium, and that will have resulted in a fact of a hypertrophic cardiomyopathic left ventricle. Okay, so now that we've scared you on cats, let's move to congenital heart diseases. So with congenital heart diseases, we're looking at mainly at young patients. Again, sometimes they can present older, but we're looking at the younger patient primarily. And so when we look at different types of congenital heart disease, perhaps one of the more common that we will see is something that we call the ventricular septal defect, so a hole in the heart. And so as we've got here the arrow where we have mixing of blood flow from the right to the left. As I said, your left ventricle is a higher pressure than your right, so blood will cross that and go across into the right ventricle, which means that then when blood goes up into the pulmonary artery, you've got a mixing of oxygenated and deoxygenated blood, which obviously isn't effective as if that wasn't happening. Quite often happens in cats particularly, and the thing to remember with ventral septal defects is that the smaller the hole, the louder the heart murmur. So it's like putting your finger across a hose, and if you put your finger part way across it, then you'll get a really high pressure, whereas if you take your finger off the hose, then you'll get a lower pressure jet coming out. And that's exactly the principle here. So a smaller hole, you actually have a louder heart murmur. We can also have what we call a patent ductus arteriosus. So we can see at the top there, and this is an abnormal communication. So where your ductus arteriosus is open and patent whilst you're in utero, and helps us when we're in utero to be able to have one system to circulate oxygenated and deoxygenated blood, but that should close on birth. There are several different factors that allow that to happen, and sometimes occasionally that won't happen. And so every time you have blood going out through the aorta, a load of it will go back into your pulmonary artery and then will then come back. And so in effect that puts more blood volume into your left side of your heart, so dilating the left atrium, dilating the left ventricle. This fortunately has a really high success rate of closure if it's done so, particularly within the first year. Okay, so if we look at valve stenosis, so we've got pulmonic stenosis, and we've also got aortic stenosis. And so this is a narrowing of the valve. So it can be just a narrowing either below the valve or above the valve, or it can actually be of the valve itself. So you can get the valves that are slightly stuck together. And again, the severity of that will depend upon clinical signs. So you might get just a heart murmur and asymptomatic, or it can be that your patient becomes so exercise intolerant, particularly if it's on the left side, that they're not able to exercise at all. So those are our stenosis of valves. But then we can also get valve dysplasia. So we've got on our tricuspid or our mitral valve. And so this can be where you've got abnormal tethering, you've got abnormally long leaflets, or you've got leaflets that can't close. And obviously on the left-hand side, and again, obviously it depends on severity, but our problems are much more apparent much earlier on the left-hand side, because our left-hand side being that main powerhouse of the body. Okay, so now we move on to arrhythmias. And so with arrhythmias, we can see that we can see different types of ones that we see in practice. And so we can see things like tachyarrhythmia, so atrial fibrillation. And so this can be seen quite often as a part of a disease process. So if that muscle gets stretched, then we can see atrial dilatation with it. So particularly with dilated cardiomyopathy, we might see an atrial fibrillation. And it's basically a result of the stretch of the atrial muscle. Which is why it can occur. But we can also see sometimes that it just happens, a lone atrial fibrillation in some larger breeds. We see it in horses, and humans can also suffer from this, but usually in small animal medicine, because it's a smaller left atrium, it's usually part of a disease process. We can also see ventricular tachyarrhythmias. These don't have to be cardiac in origin. As we spoke before, there are some diseases like dilated cardiomyopathy that predispose to ventricular tachycardias. But obviously, we're probably more used to seeing this with things like GDVs or emergencies that we might see in practice. And then we can also occasionally see bradyarrhythmias. So this is an example of a dog that had a heart rate of 12, and I did actually count this myself, but that ECG shows a very convincing third degree AV block. And so with a heart rate as low as 12 beats a minute, then that's not sustainable with keeping a patient up and about. And so the solution that happens here, so this is the same dog that has a pacemaker implanted. So the pacemaker is implanted under surgical conditions, through the right jugular and placed into the right ventricle. So then we've got pericardial disease. So again, this is something that we can see in practice, where we can see things like tumours that will cause this, can be idiopathic. But basically what happens is that you get an effusion within the pericardium. And so that puts pressure onto the heart. And so it's not able to relax and fill as it should be able to. Okay, so we said we'd come back to look at heart failure. And so with heart failure, we said that it's a heart disease that causes signs of increased tissue perfusion or tissue water or decreased tissue perfusion. And so we can either get congestive heart failure, which is backward failure. And so this is where you've got too much pressure within the heart itself, which builds up. So that's your increased tissue water, which goes to or becomes pulmonary edema or pleural effusion or ascites. Or we can see it where the heart is unable to produce enough output. And so we call that forward failure. And so this is where we see the decreased tissue perfusion. So we've got exercise intolerance, we've got lethargy, and we can see hypotension as well. So the heart, like for example in some of the cardiomyopathies, we can see that the heart is unable to create the cardiac output that's needed. Okay, so we start having a look at the reasons why the heart failure will happen. And so this would be, so something, for example, like an increased atrial volume. So where we've got mitral valve disease, we've got, so we can have a stretching of that left atrium, and so we've got, where we have that possible atrial fibrillation, but that can also lead back to problems with our atrial filling, so pulmonary edema, and also possibly even to right-sided problems. We've also then got things like increased ventricular filling pressure. So things like we said, so hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, you can't relax those ventricles enough. So that will cause increased pressure, to which will cause higher pressures within your left atrium and backwards. Then we can also have things like our increased extracardiac pressure. So if we see in this picture of, on the right-hand side, so this one here, where you've got your pericardial effusion. So you can see your normal heart there, but you've actually got a pericardial effusion. So where I've put the arrow there, you can also see it on the other side, on the left-hand side. And that will not allow the heart to able to constrict and fill as it must do. And then we can also see, so increased circulating blood volume. So we've got things like dilated cardiomyopathy. And so because you're not able to get enough blood out through the aorta, the body and its compensatory new mechanisms will increase the amount of blood volume. And so so you will get a volume overload, which will cause your heart, which will cause heart failure. So we've got a whole list of things, of clinical signs there of heart failure, so that we will see. So respiratory difficulty or distress, tachypnea. Remember we said about cats, so we can see with cats that we won't get that cough, but we will see that with dogs potentially. Exercise intolerance. We've also got reduced appetite, ascites. We've also got weakness and collapse that we can see as well. So this idea of having of either having too much tissue water or that we've not got enough to perfuse the body. Okay, so we'll just look very briefly at the classification system. I'm aware of the time. So if we have a look at the classifications, classification systems, so this is a paper that was written for canine valvular heart disease. And so it's looking particularly at mitral valve disease, but it's very, very useful for what we do. So we've got, basically we've got stage A or class A that we call it. And so these are patients that are at high risk of developing heart disease, but they've got no structural disorder. So we've got, for example, Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. So by being born a Cavi, you're at high risk of developing mitral valve disease. However, you do not have heart disease at the moment. As we said with cats, this will be your Bengals, your Ragdolls, that mean you're likely to get it, but you haven't got it at the moment. Then we've got stage B. So this is now where you've got structural heart disease, but you have never developed signs of heart failure. So going back to our beginning where we were talking about terminology, so we would be able to see either on radiography or echocardiography that there are signs of disease. We hear a murmur now, essentially, but we have got no clinical signs of failure. This is separated into two different classes. So we've got B1. So this is our patient with changes, or sorry, but B1 is with no radiographic or echo changes. So we might be able to hear a murmur, but there's been no structural change. So we've got no left atrial enlargement, we've got no left ventricular enlargement. So that's B1. Then we have B2. So now these are patients who do have an increased left atrial size or left ventricular size. But so you have got the structural changes, but you still have no signs of heart failure. As soon as you develop signs of heart failure, you then move into stage C. And so stage C is where you either have heart failure or you've got past signs associated with heart failure. So stage C encompasses a huge group as to those who come into our patients that do have mitral disease. They're on diuretics, they're on this, that and the other, but they can live okay, to the ones that come in with life-threatening heart failure. And then there's one final group, and that those are our patients that have clinical signs of heart failure that are now refractory to standard therapy. So those are the ones that are already on the bucket of drugs, but the bucket of drugs aren't enough anymore. And so your vets are perhaps looking for different things they can give. They may be looking at some sort of more fancy or hard-hitting diuretics. But these are the patients that on your normal doses of furosemide, they're now, it doesn't make a difference to it at all. So those are our classifications of heart disease. So really, when we're looking at diagnosis, we're looking at either from the clinical signs or from physical examination. So auscultation will tell us a lot in a lot of cases, but is not everything. So with the other things we look at are echo, x-ray, ECG, or possibly even angiocardiography. So echo is seen to be the gold standard of detecting heart disease, because what you're able to do with echocardiography is to look at chamber size, to look at the wall thickness, to measure contractility, to look at valve structure. We can also see cardiac masses, and we can see effusion. So we can see if effusion is pericardial or whether it's pleural. So it's a really useful tool to be able to diagnose heart disease. Radiography is seen as the gold standard of assessing heart failure. And what we can also do is, we've said animals can cough for different reasons. So it can rule out any concurrent disease process, so neoplasia or any kind of fibrosis within the lungs. It can also measure the cardiac size and look at the cardiac silhouette. And radiographs are particularly useful because we can see on this particular slide here, so you've got your normal on the left-hand side, but we can see, for example, where you've got your arrows in the top picture on the right hand side, where you've got an enlarged left atrium. We can see tracheal elevation, so compare this to your normal slide. And we can also see that caudal lung field there on the bottom picture, where you can see pulmonary edema. We can also see pleural effusion, so we can see that fluid line there, arrow number 4, and we can also see venous congestion on radiographs as well, so that's arrowed there as well. What radiography is also very useful is, if you don't have a cardiologist, what you're able to do is to track disease. So as we said earlier, it's not necessarily a death sentence if you've got mitral valve disease, but this actually is a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. And you can see from 1999 to 2004, the progression of the disease to heart failure. So it can be really used in a really useful and helpful way to track the actual patient normal. So ECG is useful, so we can assess the heart rate. We can also assess the heart rhythm as well. And obviously, with things where we're suspicious of ventricular arrhythmias, we can see if there's an arrhythmia there or atrial fibrillation. What we can also do, so some referral centres will do Holter monitoring. So this is a 24 ambulatory ECG, and this will help patients who have syncopal episodes. We see this particularly with dilated cardiomyopathy, but there are also some other diseases which can suffer from this. And then if you do work in a referral centre, so looking for things like angiocardiography, and so this is really very useful so you can do a contrast study and you can actually see cardiac and vascular anatomy. And so for diagnosing congenital diseases, this is really very, very useful. So really, just sort of bringing it to an end and looking at how nurses can help and the role of the nurse. So things like blood tests, blood pressure, we can weigh our patients regularly, we can monitor their appetite, things like noting their body condition score and muscle condition score, and discussing with owners exercise intolerance. These are things that maybe owners are aware of, but equally as well, maybe they're not. And so when we're looking at blood tests, and we can obviously recommend them to a vet, but we're looking at things like renal function electrolytes, particularly if they're on diuretics, to make sure that their kidneys are functioning correctly. With biochemistry to rule out any other disease process, hematology to make sure that we're ruling out things like anemia or any other infection that can cause problems, thyroid hormones, we've looked at cats and how hyperthyroidism can have a problem. We can also do things like biomarkers, so things like the CardioPET proBNP test or cardiac troponins. We can also see for some breeds there are genetic markers available as well. And then obviously a huge thing that I'm very passionate about is measuring blood pressure and measuring that reliably and repeatedly. So calmly, using a format, writing down everything that you've done so that that can be repeated, so we can actually get genuine blood pressure readings. So really and finally, the key messages that we can take from this seminar are that there's a range of diseases that can vary in severity. And so remembering that patients can have heart disease and be absolutely fine, and there are some that have heart disease and in no way, shape or form are fine. It's useful to understand heart failure as it applies to all diseases. So when we look at heart failure, we really look at left-sided failure and right-sided heart failure, left-siding being the more common that we will see in practice. And I passionately believe that nurses should really get involved, because we can ensure quality of life not only to our patients, but also to our owners as well. Thank you very much for listening.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Charlotte for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.